Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Good morning, and welcome to Sara Gone Rogue. Now, I'd like to just take this opportunity, more than anything, to thank my sound engineer, Craig Guthrie. He's seen me through some years doing the slot, and now he and I are on a mission to go a little rogue, and we'll see how that develops over time. But otherwise, the purpose of this morning, is to present issues of politics, local and foreign. And we will look at, in the guest slot, we will look at the recent polling of the Institute of Race Relations, because the first issue raised dealt with the surprise that at the time the poll was done, the DA was in fact more popular than the ANC, and that was one big reveal. Today we're dealing with the reveal of what South Africans and voters want from the government, and essentially how large the gap between the ANC, and I would argue the EFF, and its constituencies actually are. And then we'll have a little riff on what happened in the White House from a more light-hearted point of view. It was extraordinary. So I've asked my guest, who will be Herman Pretorius, to stay on board to discuss that. And otherwise, we are going to look at the third budget. Now, the reality is, and I think the general view is, that in a way it had to be passed because we couldn't go through the rejection of a third budget. And the ANC certainly came to the party with head bowed and with a sort of shamefaced after essentially the DA won that fight on VAT. But just to give you a bit of background, after removing VAT completely from the equation, the consolidated government expenditure is now set to increase at an annual rate of 5.4%. That's from 2.4 trillion to 2.8 trillion. But the anticipated revenue will be 2.2 trillion or 28% of GDP. So you end up with a deficit of 377.9 billion or 4.8% of GDP. Sorry about all the figures. But essentially that deficit is going to put pressure on the government to borrow money. And those new loans will then be added to the debt pile, which will rise to 77.4% of GDP. So what you have is the servicing the debt costs 1.2 billion rand per day. And that puts the following in perspective. I happened to catch, quite accidentally, a Worldview podcast interview with Davy Ruert, the economist. And Davy Ruert I like my economists to be, you know, to express things in a tone that is a truck full of shovels rather than, you know, nice and calm and collected, but always fun. He said that this fight, shall we say it, this over VAT really resulted in being a lose-lose for the ANC. And although he's in favor of VAT increases, Davy Ruert, but provided we reduce some other more damaging taxes, which the whole tax regime, in his view, needs to be done, redone. He says he's against the VAT increase because the politicians are spending too much money. They must spend less, and the only way you get politicians to do that is to give them less. I know that sounds a bit obvious, but that's typical housekeeping, well, it should be. If you give them more money, they're going to spend it more. And after they spent it, they're then going to borrow to get more money. And he's also against giving more money to SARS. He doesn't want a more efficient SARS. He wants a SARS that's less efficient, because if it's more efficient, they're going to take more money out of the private sector's hand and give it to the state, which is a waste of money. And although we all have to pay our dues, if you look at the current tax system in South Africa, it's generally highly unequal and highly unfair. He was quite amused by the fact that the smaller parties, BOZA, SASA, ANC, not so much the smaller, say that in reality they also that they take credit for the getting rid of that, when in reality they had all actually supported it. So they are, as he says, lying. And they think we're stupid and can't see that. They mustn't try to pretend that South Africa is safe from that proposed increase. So VAT wasn't increased, and this interview occurred just before the third budget, and he was right about that, and that an agreement would be reached. But the most fascinating thing about this podcast was what he said about what 0.5% increase in VAT would have given us. Now, 0.5% would have given the minister 13.5 billion extra per year. He doesn't think it would have been achieved because we have a very weak economy with weak demand, and maybe the fiscus would have obtained 10 billion a year. And it comes down to give or take 1 billion rand per month. Now, if you remember, we're paying 1.2 billion rand a day to service our debt. But let's have a look at some of those bigger figures. The total outstanding debt of the state is 5,600 billion rand. The balance on the account, on the positive, is roughly 200 billion rand. That's contained in the tax loan accounts and the exchange account. But there's another account called the Golden Foreign Exchange Contingency Reserve Account. And the balance of that at the moment is between 350 and 400 billion. And it fluctuates between 20 and 40 billion rand per month. So what the ANC was really trying to do was, in his words, ruin the country for 1 billion rand per month. Now, last year they collected approximately 8 or 9 billion rand more than they planned to. So they started off this year with a surplus of 8 billion rand, and yet they wanted to bring the country down for 1 billion rand per month. And Davi, being Davi, I think called it as it is. He says it's immature, it's political grandstanding. He thinks the Minister of Finance must be fired, or he must resign, or whatever. There should, in fact, and I agree with this, be a general election. But for there to be a general election, you'd have to have the ANC agreeing to it. But his takeaway essentially is that it's not about the money, but it's about politics. The ANC wanted to show the DA what they could do. It's about politics. It was about bad politics. And the ANC came out of it with a bloody nose. So he does identify some good news. The discipline of the Reserve Bank keeping inflation low, 3% roughly, and keeping it steady. And because our monetary policy is very restrictive, we really don't have much choice given the fiscal side of government, the spending more than we have or we're bringing in. So the Reserve Bank acts as a sort of balance on the nonsense that's occurring within the economy. Again, in typical Davi fashion, he calls the political leaders mostly a bunch of amateurs and they act like a bunch of children. But he says that in itself is a sign of a good thing and something I feel strongly about, and that's freedom of speech. Because in South Africa, he can say things like that. The press is allowed to communicate with experts who analyze what's going on. And we can, as a result, really take on the politicians and the president. And I would endorse that. I don't think we, as my mantra goes, you can never take free speech for granted into the future. But having it and regarding it as normal is incredibly important. And what the third thing he feels is a good thing is the fact that the ANC did concede after the last election. I could agree. I think it's very healthy for democracy. I think it's exactly a sign that we are a democratic country. I suspect partly the reason they conceded is because they couldn't have managed the process of fighting it. So they conceded and the GNU happened as a consequence. And finally, he says that the judiciary, while deteriorating, we still have a healthy constitution and a constitutional court that upholds the principles in the constitution and abides by the rule of law. I have some doubts about that, but that's for another program.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'd like to welcome my colleague back onto Chai FM, Herman Pretorius, the head of strategic something or other. He can fill me in on that. And Herman, you have come to the second reveal of our survey, which survey originally, when we discussed it previously, we discussed the extraordinary finding that at that point in which it was done, the DA was just actually more popular than the ANC. So that was like baba boom. So what do you have for us today with regard to what it is that the people in South Africa actually want?
Yeah, so that was quite the bombshell finding. For the first time in IRR polling history, the DA outscored the ANC. DA just above 30%, ANC just below. The consequence, of course, of the VAT debate at that time. I wish we could have polled every day since then to see how things have stood. But if my sources within the various parties are anything to go by, that picture has stayed remarkably consistent with the DA and the ANC, both around 30%, vying for that top spot. So really an interesting time of shifting political alliances. Now, looking at our second of three polling reports, first one looking at the political picture, this one looking at the policy preferences, our next one that I'm currently working on, looking at race relations in South Africa. These policy preferences are quite fascinating, and we have seven key takeaways. Number one, job creation remains the top national priority, and it should come as a surprise to absolutely no one. This has been the case in every poll I've looked at that we've done on this priority, and it's not even close. South Africans want job creation and jobs by a massive margin, with the next ranking issues of illegal immigration, crime, corruption, safety and security, all of them important. But we've got unemployment at 30% of South Africans saying that's point number one, and the next five all below 10%. So it's not even close. South Africans want jobs. Takeaway number two, in this time of increased chatter about race-based policies, the doubling down of employment equity, race audits and targets, surprise, surprise, merit trumps race. 84% of South Africans want to see appointment based on merit, not on race. That's a combination of people who say that it should be merit first, with special training for people from disadvantaged backgrounds. Training, not special employment. People I've seen sort of confuse this with a form of BEE. BEE isn't special training. BEE is special treatment. So you've got a merit plus special training, 53.5%, and then pure merit, 30.5%. Merit trumps race. Then value for money trumps race-based procurement targets. The government, as we know, needs to buy stuff, whether it's stationery, toilet paper, uniforms, whatever. Currently, how it works is the government doesn't buy stuff on the value for money basis. It buys stuff on, you know, BEE basis by a massive majority, again, of 81.7%, again, over 80%. South Africans reject race-based procurement. They want value for money. The Expropriation Act, finding number four, unpopular. 68.1% of South Africans think the act is bad. They oppose it. Work trumps welfare. 77.8% of South Africans want the government to focus on work and job creation, not welfare. Choice trumps current empowerment policies. That means when it comes to housing, education, and healthcare, South Africans want a leg up in the form of vouchers where they can choose the hospital, they can choose the school, they can choose the housing option that works best for them rather than current employment equity or affirmative action or BEE policies that really only cater to an elite. And finding number seven, which I think is the sort of the slightly wow moment in this poll, on every policy polled in this report, the ANC is on the wrong side of not only the public opinion, but the opinion of its own supporters. On merit versus race, ANC has gone from race, its supporters want merit. Its supporters, by 79%, higher than the national average, oppose the Expropriation Act, and on it goes. The ANC is out of step with its own feet.
Just to start there and work backwards, perhaps, I think this was reflected in the ANC's result in May 2024. It went below 50. It didn't just go below 50. It didn't just cease to be the majority party of 30 years. it went to 40%. Now, we know and discussed on the show the fact that you have a sort of floating ANC vote that isn't quite sure, unhappy with what the ANC is doing. But if the ANC would do something right, they'd probably float back. I think that's becoming less and less of a threat. I think the gap is widening because every one of the items you mention, all seven, are common sense. They are aspirational, irrespective of colour, irrespective of race and ethnicity. And just to pick up perhaps and comment on this, property rights, you know, you've got this song and dance routine of expropriation. It's becoming a big issue in our trying to renegotiate our relationship with the US. But it's aspirational. I think people fundamentally do understand that being able to own property is part of what grows your ability to look after yourself and your children better. It's a value. It has value, and you can build on that value. Your comment.
And I think people understand that property rights are not an add-on to ordinary life, as it were. For the reason I'm for property rights goes back to a very, very simple question. Who owns my time on earth? Because what I do with my time allows me to earn an income. Right. What I do with my income allows me to own things. So if I own my time, then I own my income, then I own what I buy with my income. But if I don't own what I buy with my income, that means I don't own my income. Mm. That means I don't own my time on earth. So it's really quite an instinctive thing that if you want to work, own things, leave something behind for your kids, ensure, I mean, everything from the horrible thing about the Expropriation Act is it targets everything from a farm to school shoes. Of course, the odds that someone's, grade one school shoes will be expropriated is zero. You know, I'm not saying that that's the case. I'm just saying that there's such a fundamental insult to people in this act that says, whatever you do, whatever you earn, whatever you buy with what you earn, remember, the state can take it. The state has that right. It's sort of like going in a relationship with a man saying, I might hit you. I'm not saying I'm going to hit you, but I hold the right to do so. Who in their right mind will think that's a healthy relationship? And that's the relationship South Africans have with the state at the moment. It's the state going, own stuff, oh, but I might take it. And of course, people hate that. Of course, you know, it's almost 70% of people hate that. And 79% of ANC voters hate that. And as you say, over the last few weeks, I've compared two elections that I think tells you everything you need to know. 2004 and 2024. Mm-hmm. ANC at its best and ANC at its worst thus far. ANC in 2004, 70% of the vote, growing economy, unemployment inching down, rollout of grant system, fiscal discipline. Before state capture really got its claws and teeth into the fabric of South Africa, BEE just introduced. We haven't been able to see it fail yet. Compare that 20 years later, 40% of the vote, unemployment skyrocketing, stagnating economy, BEE, clearly not black economic empowerment, blatant elite enrichment. It is a long time coming. People shouldn't think that the ANC collapsed suddenly. It's been a long time coming, and they've lost their ability to not listen to South Africans, but to their own supporters as well.
Absolutely. I agree. And I think that gap is going to increase unless a sort of moment of clarity suddenly arises and the ANC says, we're terribly sorry, Trump is right, let's do things differently. I just want to make another point about property rights that perhaps we sort of don't think about, but I think is crucial. The thing about owning property is it's not the house you own or is not necessarily in and of itself a great investment. It provides other things that are crucial to your life. It's cover, it's comfort, it's literally protection. It's also, if it's yours, you can sell it. And if you sell it and you make a mistake in doing so and, you know, you end up, you know, earning much less from the sale than you anticipated, that is your problem. In other words, you must have the agency to do with your life to fail and succeed. It's not up to the state to decide, and generally what they decide is you know, that you're going to fail because you have no control. And I think that's a point, sorry, it's a little off topic, but I think that's a point that we need to make, is a complete, what's part of that gap between the ANC and its supporters is a decreasing loss of agency. And for the ANC to be proud of the fact that we have more people on social grants than in employment is devastating, because it's not something to be proud of. It is something to be fundamentally ashamed by.
And I think the data shows this. These are valid observations as a human experience, but they are made so much more valid by the fact that the data supports this. We ask South Africans directly, do you think the government should focus on job creation, or do you think the government should focus on expanding welfare support? That's how we got to this finding that work trumps welfare, with 77.8% of people saying, please, job creation. And your point about what property is so important. We call it home for a reason. I mean, home in literature, in poetry, in music, it has such a meaning, because it is where we belong. It is where we can be acknowledged. And if we think about something silly, like, you know, my phone or whatever, I own that phone because I have control over it. I have exclusive rights over it. I can decide whether someone else uses it. It is mine. It is dignity. It is respecting the fact that what I earned, I put into that, and that is how I earned it, with the, you know, with sweat and the labor of my day. To undermine that is to be disrespectful to South Africans who I think have frankly had, especially Black South Africans, who frankly had almost a century of solid disrespect foisted on them by governments of all shapes and sizes. It is so intrinsic, this idea that you have the right to say what is yours, and work for it and be proud of it and leave it to your kids. I mean, if I remember as a boy when my dad was a terribly prudent man. He only bought one car in the 30 plus years I've been on earth. He's only driven two cars, an old white Jetta and a new white Jetta, a Volkswagen Jetta. And I remember when he got that Jetta, the new one, I was mad. It was like, this is his. He worked for this. I will can now be dropped off at school in something that people can look at and say, Herman's dad, he, you know, that's a new car guy. So simple, but it's so basic, just to have what you work for respected. And that's why I think the ANC has seen this long-term rejection, because, yeah, at the start, the first 10 years had good stuff. Rollout of service delivery, unemployment dipping down. And that's respect, that's dignity. For the last few years, since 2004, 2007, I think the ANC has become increasingly associated with an insult to dignity rather than a bastion and an expansion of it.
Right. I'd like to shift to something I picked up from your polling. As you looked at and I'm going to concentrate on the EFF just because they're very, you know, in the news at the moment for all the right, wrong reasons. And the polling, and I mean, before this program, Howard Feldman interviewed Mandy Wiener, and her take on that, you know, the EFF came out of Malay, I don't know what to call it, the Trump Malay, came out, you know, that it would, you know, very good for him, for his supporters. But I actually think the same gap is opening up between the EFF and its supporters as happened with the ANC and its supporters. And when you look at your graph, and I mean, there's nothing like a graph to really sort of figure the mind, but we can't do that on radio. You have nearly 40% of EFF supporters want jobs. Okay, for obviously, you know, the way the EFF does its stuff, illegal immigration is seen as a considerable issue by, say, 25%. The next issue, nearly 20%, is crime or safety and security. And it goes on. And at the bottom, racism is somewhere a little... They're not even on the EFF spectrum. They're not there at all. They're worried about abuse of women and children, water and sanitation. What makes them different from the rest of us? But I don't think the EFF may look impressive or thinks it looks impressive. But it's again, miles away from its supporters. And I think the fascinating insight I think it was Gareth van Onselen did in some recent polling is that 57% of EFF supporters identify the song Kill the Boer, Kill the Farmer as clearly hate speech. And that 26% said the singing was irresponsible. So you've basically got 83% of EFF supporters saying that's irresponsible hate speech. I mean, what people may have hoped for in the EFF is not necessarily what the EFF is giving them. Is it the same thing?
And I think what's so important about this observation is we shouldn't overestimate the rationality of voting decisions, nor should we overestimate, similarly, the rationality of consumer decisions. I mean, the whole area of consumer science looks into, you know, whether a product is placed 30 centimeters high or 30 centimeters lower affects how it is purchased. The branding. We like to think of ourselves as bargain hunters. You know, what's the best value for price? But the consumer doesn't think that way always. We've got all these weird sort of emotive and sub-rational and supra-rational and whatever decisions that flow into what we buy, and the same goes into what we vote. And I think where the EFF has been more successful than the ANC in terms of keeping its 10% of the vote relatively steady is for two reasons. Number one, it has never been in government of a substantive position where there was an expectation that it ought now to deliver on its rhetoric. So it's never been proven false in its promises made. So it can still sort of make those promises. And the second thing is, they have still maintained, if you look at the EFF's land radicalism, they're always connected to jobs. Land and jobs now is one of their slogans. Land and jobs.
Yeah.
So even where land forms part of the EFF rhetoric, it is under the guise and associated with this issue of jobs. So the EFF, I think, have an emotive base that is sort of that makes decisions different from how I would, but that isn't no less valid. But part of it is this fact that what is the status quo isn't working, and the EFF is promising something radical. Whether its voters look into the details of that radicalism, whether it's an intensification of what's gone wrong or a rejection of what's gone wrong, at least there's something like change being offered, and it's change always connected to jobs, always connected to this top priority of dignity. So I by no means defend the EFF, but I think they do a better job of maintaining rhetorical tone attached to what South Africans want, rather than the nonsense of the ANC's let's do more together or we've got a good story to tell.
And certainly, I mean, I was talking about Davy Ruert's comments of the VAT increase saga, and he felt, and I think with validity, that the DA and the EFF came out of that saga better than most, for all the right rational reasons. Herman, I'm going to thank you there for this. I've asked you to stay on after the ads so we can riff on the Trump event brought to you by Monty Python. And thank you. Hang on and we'll talk. If you have a small business, think about this. Imagine you ran an amazing special offer, and imagine a Chai FM told 125,000 people about it. Imagine we also posted your special offer on our social media platforms and listed you on our website. And imagine you could do all of that on a month-to-month basis. What would it be worth to you? Chai FM has a special stimulus package for small business, and you should get in touch to find out more. Email info@chaifm.com or send a text to +27 61 895 1019 and we'll call you. 1019 Chai FM, 101.9 megahertz of building community businesses.
Chai FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Herman, the president and his team went to America to get investment. By the time that meeting finished in the Oval Office, the only takeaway: this country is way too dangerous and problematic to invest in. What an achievement.
Yes. The thing is, love him or hate him or whatever, Trump has a modus operandi that is to take something with a grain of truth and to make it absurd, ridiculous, provocative, but unignorable. And if we think about his background of reality television, that's what reality television is. Take something real, something ordinary, blow it out of proportion, and people can't ignore it. They can't look away. That's what the Oval Office was. It was a moment of supremacy TV, where the mission for the Ramaphosa delegation was so clearly one thing, and the fact that Ramaphosa wasn't prepped on the farm killing stuff. I mean, there is no white genocide in South Africa. That is not the case, but there is farm murders, and there is a disproportionate number of white South Africans as farmers. So you are going to get this horrifically skewed murder rate with the violence that goes with it. But the fact that Ramaphosa wasn't even prepped on that is rather, I think, a reflection of the out of depthness of a president that I think faced the first substantive media engagement of his presidency in the bloody Oval Office, not in the Union Buildings, not here, the Oval Office. How extraordinary!
Well, the one thing we could be certain of, the only thing that we could be certain of, was that knowing Cyril, he wouldn't lose his temper. It wouldn't be a Zelensky moment. And frankly, the audience in the room was too big. I mean, you really ran the risk of sort of exciting the crowd, and the crowd it was, both in terms of journalists and in terms tended. But my other cringeworthy moments came from the rich guys, the Anton Rupert, Ernie Els, Retief Goosen, I think, held his own and gave emphasis to that, the issue of farm murders. But there is nothing like watching rich guys who are very good at what they do, and that's why they've become very rich, know nothing about politics and have absolutely no sense on the ground. And so they don't add in that respect. And it's a larger problem in society here in general, is, you know, the guys with the financial muscle sort of take a long time to come to the party. Now, going back to the Mandy Winnie interview, she mentioned that speaking to government people, they felt they had done a good job. You know, that there will be trade irrespective of whether Goa goes or not, which it is likely to do. And she said that the very fact that the General Secretary of COSATU was able to speak was a sign of the influence of COSATU on the ANC. Maybe, but I think it was actually quite irrelevant. In that room, I could have had the opportunity to speak if I was standing there, and where would that have got us? So really, it was bizarre, it was extremely entertaining, and generally sort of cringeworthy. I'll add to that, you talk about him not being prepped on the issue. Two things struck me, and I wonder your take on it. The first was seeing that clearly, but hearing Julius Malema chant to a crowd of kill the boer, kill the farmer, and then ratatatatatata, actually was very chilling, because we've become so used to that as part of our zeitgeist that we got a sense of what it sounded like to people living in a first world democracy. That was one thing. The other thing was that memorial stroke protest of farmers driving through Natal slowly with the crosses placed along the side. We all saw that. It was very newsworthy. It could not be avoided. And it was actually very moving, whatever your position is. And Cyril had no idea what it was.
I think what you say about the kill the boer, kill the farmer is absolutely right. It was sort of, we have this thing of, oh, well, it's just Julius being Julius. He would say that, wouldn't he? But hearing it through the prism of the Oval Office, I think, did give a bit of shock value to something that had become so mundane for us. We've become blunted to it. And it's part of that thing that Trump grabs a hold of a bit of truth and then blows it up. There's truth is stoking hatred. There is disconcerting truth in it. And I think the meeting wasn't a catastrophe. Yeah. I think we can acknowledge that. If the standard is Zelensky being thrown out, then of course it didn't fall to that level. Yeah. And it's, my position has been that it was neither a success nor a fear. That is still to be determined, if I can put it that way. The Trump spotlight is now shining on South Africa and on the ANC and on Afrikaners. What we reveal in the Trump spotlight is what's going to retroactively make the meeting a success or failure. If the ANC, under the glare of the Trump spotlight, can rediscover a bit of pragmatism, then I think it will be to their credit, perhaps a little too late.
Yeah.
But the Trump spotlight is a bit of it's a revealer. It's not necessarily a trigger for action. So I thought it was amazing that for the first time ever, Ramaphosa seemed to say that kill the Boer, kill the farmer wasn't okay.
Yeah.
Never bothered to say that on domestic soil.
No.
So well done for, you know, the pressure and the situation for bringing that about. And then the question of Kusatu speaking, that was interesting to me, because it was Kusatu, a leftist, communist, socialist aligned entity, asking for a Western capitalist nation to please come and invest in our country. How far we've come from Bladen Zimande's nonsense about an strike and the like. So I think what it wasn't was ineffectual.
Yeah.
It changed things. Something changed in the Oval Office for South Africa that day. But it's still up to us to decide what it was in a way. So I don't think, and ironically, I thought John Steenhuisen really did the best with what he could have done in that moment. I think the pressure cooker of that moment, being in the Oval Office, being a minister from the DA, being asked without preparation to speak to something, I thought he handled himself well. The DA has always been best when they could be the adult in the room. So I think of everyone there, him rather than Mr. Rupert with his open cottage doors in his luxurious secure Graafreinet in enclave. I think Mr. Steenhuisen did his party proud.
Right. I agree. I think it brought out his inner parliamentary speaker. Herman, thank you very much. Glad for the little riff. It's as you say, it's a work in progress. We'll see how progressive it will become or not. Thanks.
Thanks, Sarah.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Well, what came out of partly out of that meeting, but really as executed by the communications minister, the DA, Solly Malatsi, is that he's gazetted changes to the ICT sector regulations that would allow for the equity equivalent of investment programs instead of obliging foreign investors to automatically give 30% ownership to approved black investors. Now, this is aimed at getting Starlink, Elon Musk's product, which is appearing around the world and is making internet connectivity available to as broad a base as possible. And in South Africa, that would mean a huge amount for those who cannot afford internet and particularly connectivity in the rural areas. And I think it would change political dynamics quite a lot, and maybe that's what the ANC is afraid of, in that the ability to improve the connection and the communication between the rural and the urban areas, and remember we are now largely majority urban country, would have an effect on how people see their lives and their politics and maybe what they demand of their political parties. I think, however, I mean, the Portfolio Committee on ICT Sector has its nose really in the collective snit and summoned Minister Malatsi to explain himself for deviating from BEE. But I think the consequences are it would be very difficult for the ANC to oppose this, whether it would be enough, because what exactly they mean by an equivalent investment programs, I'm not sure, and we'll have to see that from Minister Malatsi's regulations. But it's a wedge in the BEE superstructure, and I think only good things can ultimately, if not immediately, come from it. Having said that, I thank you for listening, and I look forward to welcoming you back while Sarah has gone rogue. See you next week.